Welcome back. We'll get back to more of my conversation with James T. Abbott, author of The Outsider's Guide to UFOs. I'll get his take on the Mariana film of 1950. The Billy Meier photographs. We must talk about the Billy Meier photos. And then some of the most interesting photographs in the world of ufology are the ones that disappeared. We'll talk about the 1957 Edwards Air Force Base missing photos. Remember Gordon Cooper, astronaut Gordon Cooper, talking about those photographs. They were handed over to the authorities with a promise that they would be given back. And of course, that never happens. Speaking of UFOs, there's a bizarre viral video claiming to show a UFO sucking energy from a lightning bolt. This was posted by conspiracy theory channel Secure Team 10. And as I say, it's gone viral, showing a UFO sucking energy from a lightning bolt. Sounds a little bit like those college pranks where, well, it's not really a prank, but, you know, kids used to siphon the gas out of somebody's car because they couldn't afford gas. I suppose this is sort of the extraterrestrial version of that. Hey, George Norrie is returning to Asheville, North Carolina. Danheiser Wagner Entertainment presents George Norrie Live, The Return to Asheville, at the Diana Wortham Theater. This is happening Saturday, August the 25th from 5 to 8 p.m. They're back and they're better than ever. Again, Saturday, August the 25th, returning to the beautiful Diana Wortham Theater for an amazing show with special guests, including the Rocket Man, David Adair, and ufologist Micah Hanks, discussing Area 51, William Forschgen, author of The Final Days and One Year After, discussing solar attacks on our planet and our grid, Asheville's own paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren in his wacky world, spiritual teacher and psychic medium Vincent Jenna, and of course there'll be a live band and George will sing a few songs. There'll be plenty of audience participation and a meet and greet to follow. This is an event you don't want to miss, so you want to get your tickets quickly. Call 828-257-4530, 828-257-4530, or you can go to the website dwtheater.com. Now let me spell theater, D-W, and then make sure you spell theater like this, dwtheatre.com, dwtheatre.com. Then you can click the Buy Tickets button and off you go. Back with more with James Abbott, The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, right here on Coast to Coast AM. James Abbott stays with us, The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, Volume 1, Mystery and Science. So I might understand then, James, there will be a Volume 2 and a Volume 3 and so forth?
Well, I'm hoping so. Volume 2 is about three quarters completed now, so that should be a definite, but I'm not sure about Volume 3. I don't know.
I want to ask you about the Mariana film of 1950. Tell us about that.
Yeah. A guy called Nick Mariana, who was a local businessman, went outside, was talking with his secretary in a car park one day, and it was a sunny day. He looked up, and he saw two objects, which he photographed from, he took a movie film, in fact, of them. He was the sort of guy who, he wasn't a UFO specialist. This was 1950, and he managed, unusually for those days, to get some context into the photograph. There was a water tower or a tower nearby, which the objects passed behind. Now, this became a cause célèbre in the States for quite a while, the Nick Mariana video, and Philip Klass got involved later on in trying to debunk it. But the way that he did it and the way that it was reported was very compelling. It was a very convincing episode. Although, if you look at the video, and there are plenty of copies online to have a look at, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are very familiar with it, it's not that convincing. It could be anything. It could be reflections from birds or aircraft or anything. But Edward Ruppelt, who was the head of Blue Book at the time, the Project Blue Book investigation, looked into it in some depth and could not explain it. And neither could his men. They also looked into things which subsequently people have said were the actual causes of it. There were a couple of US Air Force F-94s in the sky that day, And a number of people say that it was reflections from them that caused Mariana to see what he thought were UFOs. But the Blue Book team back in the day did not think it was those F-94s. In fact, they thought that they had already landed before Nick Mariana took that video. And also, there's a small fact that a number of other people in the town also saw them. And interestingly, and this is always the case with video and photographic evidence, it's always not as good as you want it to be. And one of the things that you always get from witnesses who take photographs is, oh God, I didn't actually take the thing the way I wanted to take it. It was too fast, or I couldn't get my camera out in time, or whatever. And Mariana actually said, and so did some of the people in the town, that these things were metallic, they were discs, and they were spinning. And that's an interesting thing to be able to see. But a lot of people in the town said they were discs and they were spinning. So the Mariana incident is in the book because I think it's a very compelling example of a good early video.
And then you contrast that, the person handling the camera was not a professional, but you contrast that with the Tremonton film of 1952, where you have a U.S. Navy chief photographer behind the camera.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Delbert Newhouse was a highly professional U.S. Navy photographer. He'd been up in the air for many, many hours, and he'd taken some very important photographs for the U.S. Navy. Now, again, you see, it wasn't that he went out looking for UFOs or anything. He was on a journey across the states with his family when his wife, and, you know, you can almost, the accounts are fairly guarded, but you can almost hear the argument in the car that sunny day, you know, her saying, there are things in the sky, Delbert, stop the car. And Delbert saying, no, we've got to get going. We've got a lot of miles to do. And his wife says, no, stop the car. This is important. There are things in the sky. So Delbert says, oh, all right, then, stops the car, gets out and sees these things in the sky. And they are pretty well right over him at that particular point in time. He then goes around to the what you call the trunk of the car, gets his camera out, fixes it up. It's a 16mm camera, so pretty good professional stock in those days. And he takes a few feet of film. The problem, of course, was that by the time he took the film, the objects were quite a distance away. And if you look at the copies that are on the web at the moment, they're fairly indistinct. They're compelling because these objects are doing all sorts of things. But again, you know, Delbert is one of the guys that you think, oh, if only he got his camera out earlier, and if only he kept a copy of the film, because that was the problem in those days. The films, you know, once you send the negatives in somewhere and they get kept, then you've lost them forever. Whereas with modern digital films, you can keep a copy and send a copy in. But the Delbert Newhouse one is one of those cases that you were alluding to earlier, where you have a film which gets sent to the authorities and it comes back without an important part of the film, because Mr. Newhouse swears that he took a photograph of one of the objects leaving the rest of them and scooting across the sky. And he said, I took that photograph specifically and I held the camera still so that you got an impression of the speed of the object. But that bit of the film never came back to him.
Well, speaking of which, missing photographs, we have to talk about the Edwards Air Force Base photos and Colonel L. Gordon Cooper, who was present when a team of photographers, they were positioned on the dry lake bed. They had some special slow motion equipment, and they wanted to capture some sort of Air Force vehicle landing. And of course, they captured something else entirely. Tell us about the Edwards Air Force Base photos.
Yeah, I love that one. This particular incident is one of those where you just can't not believe that something happened. It was again a nice sunny day. Well, are there any other types of day at Edwards Air Force Base? I've never seen a photograph of Edwards Air Force Base in the rain. But Gordon Cooper was a captain at the time, and he sent his two photographers out to take some very important photographs of an aircraft using a new guided landing system that they were trying to develop. And the guys set up on this dry lake bed at a point where they could take good photographs of the aircraft coming in. And they were doing this, evidently, early in the morning from about 8 o'clock onwards. And later on, about an hour later, they rushed up to Gordon Cooper. They drove back to base, rushed up to the captain and said, "You'll never believe, but we've taken photographs of something that landed beside us, you know, about 50 yards away." So Cooper must have laughed and said, "Well, you know, have you got any film of this?" And the two guys said, "Well, yeah, strangely enough, we have. We've got still photographs and we've got movie film." So Cooper said, "Well, okay, if he's that serious, I'll phone it in." So he phoned in this sighting of an object which landed 50 yards from these photographers and was then filmed and photographed itself. And he filmed it into higher authorities, who said, "Send us the negatives, do not keep copies, and do not look at any, certainly don't take any prints, and don't look at them, the prints." So Cooper said, "Yeah, okay," being a good Air Force officer, he, you know, obeyed orders. And so the courier arrived a few hours, presumably later, when the movie film itself had been developed into a proper negative. And Cooper swears, he swore to his dying day that he never looked at that, followed orders, never looked at it. But they didn't order him, oh, sorry, it was the other way around, he didn't look at the prints. But they hadn't told him not to look at the film, and he did unwind the film and look at a few frames of it. And he says it was extremely compelling. There were, you know, it was an object, and the guys had taken film of it. But once that film and those photographs went off to higher authorities, it was never seen again. And that was one of the reasons Cooper thought that there was a cover-up going on in the U.S. government right the way from that period of time back in the late 50s.
And this object was, what, about 50 feet or 50 yards from these photographers?
About 50 yards away, yep.
Right. And it landed on, I guess, what would be described as sort of a tripod or three legs?
Yep. It was three-legged. It was circular in shape. And it was very like a number of other descriptions. And this is, again, one of the things that when you start studying UFOs, you get hooked by, because witness after witness after witness come up with similar sorts of things that they see, tripod legs and circular objects, but with variations, of course.
And I think it's important to spend a few moments talking about the character of the witness in this case, Gordon Cooper.
I know I'm a Brit, but I actually love Gordon Cooper. I think he was a brave man. And he was a true American hero. And to be honest, he was a hero for the West. Cooper actually fell asleep in his Gemini capsule one day. He was one of the very early astronauts. And sometimes we forget how dangerous those early flights were. They, you know, the guys didn't say much about it, but they were incredibly dangerous, sitting on top of what were effectively ballistic missiles and being fired out into orbits in low Earth orbit, where the capsule could have burned up. If it wasn't quite the right orbit, it was a bit lower than normal, then you were dead. But those guys did it, and Cooper was one of the only ones to actually fall asleep. On another occasion, he actually landed his capsule without any computer control at all, just using his wristwatch and his mind to calculate the descent trajectories and the timing.
Right, a true American hero, and he never recanted that story. He maintained it right up until the end, right?
Yeah, and a number of other ones. He said he always claimed that he was told by other officers that they had seen similar things, but they weren't going to tell anybody because they didn't want to ruin their careers.
Earlier we were talking about photographs or film where it's, oh, I wish I had, you know, focused it better, or I wish I had different angles. So, you know, where people complain that the quality is never there, or the opposite. They complain that, oh, that's just too perfect, which brings us to the Billy Meier photographs. What are your feelings about the Billy Meier photographs? I mean, they are remarkable pieces of art, really, when you look at them. But are they too perfect?
My instinct is yes, they're too perfect. But I, you know, as I say in the book, the important thing in ufology is to keep an open mind, to look at everything with an open mind and not discount something just because you have a prejudice against either the person who's telling the story or the way that they have put the evidence together or whatever. So for me, Billy Meier is one of the people on the fringes of the subject who has some extremely compelling, I mean, as you say, almost too compelling evidence. And it's a bit like a witness to a bank robbery coming in and saying to the police, look, I can give you an exact description of all five of the robbers. You know, they were wearing masks, but I know exactly what they were like. And then doing complete photo fits of every single one of those five people, height, weight, build, gait, everything. That's just too good. The police would say, no, we're not going to accept that sort of evidence. So for me, Billy Meier, and there are a number of other people who are similar to Billy, who think that they are, who claim that they have met extraterrestrials and that they have been contacted by them. And we just have to keep an open mind and say, well, actually, we can't prove it or disprove it.
I want to talk about some of the more compelling UFO cases, and I want to start with the Air Force bases. We talked about Edwards Air Force Base. Many of us are familiar, of course, with the Malmstrom Air Force Base back in 1967 that housed these nuclear missiles. Fewer people, I would imagine, are as familiar or may not be familiar at all with the Loring Air Force Base case in 1975. That's in Maine, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Loring Air Force Base. We just have a few minutes to the break, but let's begin. Just sort of walk us through this case.
Yeah, Loring is one of those ones that you can take in two ways, because there are at the time the authorities believed that what was being experienced was helicopter incursions into U.S. Air Force bases armed with nuclear weapons. So Loring is in Maine, where it's about as far north as you can get in Maine, and the reason that the U.S. Air Force put a base there was because it was the closest they could possibly get to the North Atlantic and Europe. So a lot of serious equipment was in Loring, including nuclear weapons. So they were very sensitive about it. And one night, a sergeant there saw an object over the weapons storage area at Loring and was very worried by it, reported it in, and the commanding officer, as he should have done, ordered the base to be locked down and an alert put out. So they went on alert, couldn't find anything particularly, and this was quite serious, according to the base commander, which, I mean, you know, we have to sympathize with him. So the next night, he said, what we need to do is, if these are helicopters coming in, I mean, he didn't know. They could be Russians. They could be, you know, sort of Chinese. It could be anybody trying to get into a U.S. Air Force base. So he said to his bosses, can I have a helicopter, please, and, you know, get some guys to help me track these down? And they said, no. They said, no, you're not having them. And so he must have frowned a little bit at that sort of reaction to what was apparently a very serious incursion. But he didn't worry about it. There was a National Guard helicopter on base, and he recruited their guys to help him for the next couple of days. But they never actually found a great deal. They chased things, and there were lights seen and all the rest of it, but they never actually found anything. And then a string of bases across the U.S.-Canadian border, right the way across, including Malmstrom, also saw the same things and experienced the same sort of things in the next few days. And it ran from Loring, right the way across to the West Coast, all of sightings, and then they just stopped.
Yeah, 1966, 1967, that was a hot year for UFO activity, up here in Canada, too. Shag Harbor in Nova Scotia and Falcon Lake. very famous. In fact, the Canadian Mint just issued a coin on commemorating Falcon Lake, but they've sold out. Here's Van Morrison taking us into the break with Bright Side of the Road, and then back with more of my conversation with James Abbott, The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, welcome back. And we will open up the phone lines at the top of the hour and take questions and comments for James Abbott, who's with us, the author of The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, Volume 1, Mystery and Science. Well, here's another mystery, perhaps, that has been solved. The 500-year-old Leaning Tower of Pisa mystery. Did I say pizza? Pisa. It's being unveiled by engineers, and they're going to find out why the Leaning Tower has survived the strong earthquakes that have hit the region since the Middle Ages. And you can read all about it up in the news section, where Sean Latasur, our webmaster, has posted that up at coasttocoastam.com. All right, back with more of James Abbott and The Outsider's Guide to UFOs on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. James Abbott is with us, The Outsider's Guide to UFOs. We want to run through a few more cases and then get into the possible origins of UFOs. Chapter 11 you dedicate to UFOs and the police. And it's interesting, as you say, that skeptics will even dismiss police as witnesses, even though they're supposedly trained observers, for the same reason that they discount testimony from pilots, that, oh, well, they can make mistakes.
Yep, that's absolutely right. I just don't understand that argument at all. We're more than willing to accept most police evidence in cases involving robberies or car accidents or whatever. So why don't we accept what the police say in these sorts of cases? And there are hundreds and hundreds of cases where police officers have reported seeing strange things, but we just don't take any notice of them. We say, well, they can be mistaken, that they could have made a mistake.
You hold up the 1965 sighting in Exeter, New Hampshire, as kind of an example of how skeptical organizations and individuals deal with UFO issues.
Yeah, I think, you see, I have great respect for the skeptics. I think they have a point, and they make some very good ones. But sometimes I think they just go too far in trying to explain something. The Exeter one is fascinating because it was an 18-year-old who saw lights early in the morning. He was on his way back from his girlfriend's home in New Hampshire, and he saw these lights, and they scared him. They were at about a 60-degree angle, red flashing lights, flashing in sequence. They rose over some trees near him and appeared to come towards him. In fact, they appeared so much to come towards him that he was scared. He ran, threw himself into a ditch and cowered there for a few minutes, wondering what to do. Well, eventually he thought, well, they haven't come for me. So he went to a house, knocked on the house door, didn't get any answers because the people weren't going to answer the door at 2 o'clock in the morning. But he got a lift to the local police station. The interesting thing at the police station was that when he walked in and said, I've seen some lights and they came towards me, the police officer didn't even blink. The sergeant behind the counter said, yeah, he said, I've heard that one before tonight, so I think we'd better look into it. And he grabbed one of his officers, a guy called Bertrand, and said, you know, take the lad back to where he saw them and see what's going on. So he did, and Bertrand and the lad were scared by exactly the same lights. In fact, Bertrand, a serving police officer, very experienced police officer, actually drew his gun because he was so worried about this thing coming towards them. Now, in those days, particularly, police officers, especially in country areas, didn't draw their guns very often. So the fact that he did says just to what extent he was scared. And the object eventually, after yet another police officer had arrived and seen it, eventually disappeared over towards the sea. And that was the end of it. That was the Exeter, New Hampshire sighting. Very, very powerful stuff. Two police officers saw something. A lad called Norman Muscarello did, and he died young, but he kept that story to the end of his life. Never really made any money out of it. He was interviewed by TV and radio and newspapers and so on, but never made any money out of it. And the the whole thing was just left like that for a long time as one of the most compelling incidents of ufology, until quite recently some skeptics decided that they would try to explain it. And one of the skeptics who tried the explanation was a guy who'd been an Air Force officer and said that he knew what was going on. And what happened around Exeter at that particular time, on that particular night, was a big exercise going on, a US Air Force exercise, and there were refueling tankers up. And refueling tankers, as you know, use booms which drop from the back of the aircraft, and they are solid booms. They are made of aluminium, and they carry the fuel, and the aircraft locks onto that boom and refuels. Now, in European air forces, that system isn't used. We use hoses, but you know, it's the same principle. These guys reckoned that it was, in fact, one of these refueling tankers that had caused all the trouble, because, as they said, lights were used on the refueling tanker to guide aircraft in, and that's absolutely true. But the lights that guide aircraft in are not that bright. They can be seen from the rear of the aircraft, but not from the side generally. And that's for obvious reasons. You don't want enemy aircraft spotting your refueling tankers and taking them out of the air without any problem. So they aren't what you would call discreet. Now, I absolutely refuse to believe this skeptical answer to the New Hampshire sightings. The refueling tankers would be at 15,000 to 20,000 feet up. And the lights from those booms, even if they were bright, would not be more than a pinprick in the sky to anybody on the ground. Certainly not large enough for a lad like Muscarello and two police officers to be scared by them.
Right. It's almost up there with the lighthouse explanation for Rendlesham Forest.
Yeah, that's very.
It's absurd, really. What are your thoughts on Rendlesham? Because there's so much conflicting testimony, and some of it is, it's a soft target for skeptics because of some of the things that have come out about Rendlesham, whether or not you believe in, you know, digital downloads and things like that. In many cases, or in many instances, I feel that the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident has almost gone off the rails. How do you feel?
Yeah, I'd agree. It's exactly the same as Roswell. The longer these incidents are allowed to mature after the actual incident, the longer they get to mature, the more confusion and debate surrounds them. And Roswell is like that as well. You know, so many different claims and counterclaims and so on. And Rendlesham is the same. But generally, there's something in each of these cases which makes you sit up and think. In Roswell, it's the fact that the press release was released. In Rendlesham, it's the character and attitude of Colonel Holt that gives me pause, because you can imagine the three bored sergeants in the security police would possibly think that it was a good joke to have a UFO incident on a cold Boxing Day night in Norfolk. And it's a very cold part of the UK in winter time. The wind sweeps in off the North Sea, and I know, because I used to live there, it will cut you in half if you're not careful. So on a cold winter's night in Norfolk, you would naturally think, okay, I'll have a joke and we'll get some exercise by going out to look for false lights. So, yeah, possibly. But Colonel Holt was a different kettle of fish altogether. He did not believe. He was a skeptic. And he was thoroughly annoyed at having his time taken up. He was dragged out of the warmth, sent out into the forest with a load of guys to try and look for these things. And much to his surprise, he actually saw things, and he recorded them faithfully. He recorded them audibly on his voice recorder, but he also recorded them in writing and sent a letter to the MOD. Now, subsequently and most recently, David Clark of the UK has interviewed his commanding officer. And the commanding officer, for me, is being a little bit disingenuous because he blames Charles Holt for that sighting and says he should never have made those claims, and certainly not made claims that the US and British governments were covering up UFOs. Now, 30 years after the event, slinging mud at your junior officer is not really the actions of an honorable guy. He should have said at the time, back in the 80s, look, Holt, come in here, stand in front of my desk and take your medicine, because what you've done last night was very silly. But he didn't. He's left it 30 years, and now he's saying that Holt was wrong to claim that the whole thing happened.
Yeah, there seems to be a whole lot of, in these cases, a whole lot of, what's the term, the CMA going on, cover my behind. While we're talking about UFOs and landings, the Valensole case in 1965 is very intriguing. Walk us through that.
Yeah, Maurice Mass. I included this case because there are a number of cases where, you know, I'm a researcher, and I like facts. I like things that I can grab hold of, test, and replicate. And UFOs are not like that. So this field was a very new one for me. And at the far end of the field is the whole area of conspiracies and abductions and experiences, as they're called these days. And at the in the middle, but still pretty extreme, are people who see aliens and things that are landed on the ground. And this was one of the cases with Maurice Mass in Valensole in the south of France. So in 1965, he walks out to his field and sees an object in it, which at first he thought was a car. He thought some kids had driven a car into his lavender field. But it turned out that the kids weren't kids at all. They got into this object, and it took off and flew away. And Maurice Mass saw this, and he saw the damage in his field and so on. And there are photographs of that. Now, the difference with France is that there is an official system for recording and reporting UFO sightings. And the French paramilitary police, the gendarmes, who are really a sort of a national guard, they are required by law to look into these cases. And in this case, they turned up and took photographs and interviewed people. And they really did grill this guy, Maurice Mass, as to what had happened. And they came up, they told their bosses in Paris that he was plausible, that he wasn't making money from it, that he wasn't trying to claim too much. But he saw two people standing by an object and they flew away. Now, you know, anybody that knows anything about the UFO sightings knows damn well that that is almost exactly like the Lonnie Zamora case a year or two later. So France has these cases, Britain has these cases, and America has these cases where things are seen to land and people, creatures, whatever, are seen to be beside the landed craft.
And then, again, the normal bias kicks in, and we trip over the truth once in a while. I think you have the quote in here from Churchill.
Yeah.
And then we get up and dust ourselves off and continue on as if nothing has happened.
Exactly.
We're coming up on the top of the hour. We'll open up the phone lines at that point and take questions and comments for James Abbott. But let me ask you, as we head into the break, we've got about 4 minutes here. After 70 years, what do we know? What can we say with great certainty about UFOs?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, isn't it? The answer is with great certainty, we can say very little. But except that it is a phenomenon that is pervasive, it goes on and on and on. And the governments say that, you know, the minute they release a report or they shut down a UFO investigation desk, like Blue Book was shut down in the States, and our Ministry of Defense UFO desk was shut down, and the French have really shackled their own UFO investigation. They always say that, you know, that will stop the hysteria, that if you shut the reporting desks down, then nothing happens. But just take a look at some of the databases online and the amount of people who are still stubbornly reporting these things in the sky. And there are some incredible sightings in the 21st century, which is what Volume 2 is about, actually, the 21st century, that are not just compelling, they're absolutely stunning.
The four possible origins for UFOs that you summarize in the book, intergalactic, obviously, we're familiar with that, an Earth origin, time-dimensional travelers, and then there's number four, even weirder. Talk to me about J. Allen Hynek's theory about UFOs.
Well, Hynek, as you know, was a scientist first and foremost, and he believed that UFOs could be explained if we researched them well enough. Unfortunately, like a lot of very well-meaning ufologists these days, there's just never enough money to do that properly. And the Hynek became fairly disillusioned towards the end of his life in terms of the way that the study was going and the results that were coming through. He thought that maybe there were other explanations for UFOs which we hadn't really considered. One of them was what he called his mind and matter theory, which was that these things actually don't exist in real life, that they are psychological projections, mental projections into people's minds by whatever the phenomenon really is. It could be any of the aforesaid things. I think it's a fascinating idea, and in a way it scares me, because if that's true, it's going to take us a long, long time to get to the bottom of this, because we don't have the ability at the moment to investigate mental facilities.
Right. I've heard a number of UFO researchers say that people in the know, that some have claimed, you know, that these are majestic 12 people and so forth, have maintained that in order to really understand UFOs, you have to understand psychic ability. I don't know if that's what Hynek might have been referring to or not. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it was. I think in a sort of roundabout way, that's what he was coming up with. But like all good scientists, he couldn't quite bring himself to say that the whole thing was actually in the mind. And he had no idea. I mean, you know, you can, back in the 40s, you could look at something solid in the sky, like the Trent photographs, and say, yeah, it's a disc, it's got little green men inside it, and it comes from another planet. But if you start getting into the psychic area, then how do you explain what is happening? And again, why is it happening? What is it about these phenomena that whoever is behind them wants us to do about them? What's the purpose?
What's the purpose indeed, sir? All right, we'll take a time out, come back, open up the phone lines for James Abbott. Here's Thin Lizzy. The boys are back in town on Coast to Coast AM.